This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is January 29th, 2020. We're actually recording on a Wednesday instead of a Thursday because my partner has plans. And this is episode 174.
I'm Scott DeLundeboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, Sonia Furstenow joins the race for leader of the BC Greens and other BC poly stories, an interview with the people behind a campaign for free birth control in BC, and we ask the question of whether the next conservative leader needs to be bilingual. First, we should thank those who help make the show possible. We're up to 84 patrons every month. Thanks to Joshua, our newest patron, for helping us continue to grow the show. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. And since the legislature's coming back soon, it's a great time to sign up. You can also find us soon at the Fan Expo Podcast Alley. We're going to be performing, doing a live show at 5:15 on Saturday, February 15th. They just announced the actress Marina Sirtis, the person who played Deanna Troi on...
Isn't it Sirtis?
Yes, her. She's going to be there from Star Trek The Next Generation. So a growing list of celebrities and us at Fan Expo. Link in the show notes. And I just wanted to take a second, as it is January 29th, to recognize that it's the third anniversary of the Quebec mosque shooting. I think the shooter, who I won't name, is undergoing a sentencing appeal right now where both the government and his lawyers are trying to argue the sentencing was not done correctly at the lower court. The government wants more and the defense wants less. We'll see, because this was a unique case where he got consecutive sentences for each crime, and there was a lot of people who didn't like that provision under the Harper government, and now they're defending it, so it'll be interesting to see where that appeal goes. But I think today, which will be a couple days when you're listening to this, we should just take a moment to remember, you know, the people who lost their lives to unrelenting hate on that terrible day. Well, let's jump into our roundup of BC Poly news. First off the bat, I think the major announcement of the week, which wasn't really a surprise, was...
We were kind of let this cat out of the bag a week or two ago now.
Yeah, when he did his like interview with the, I think it was Vancouver Sun, after he announced he was leaving the party, it was that Sonia Furstenow, one of the sitting MLAs, the one who's not the interim leader and who didn't leave the party, is launching a bid to lead the Greens. So Sonia Furstenow is the...
de facto front runner, I think?
Yeah.
Probably the right way to characterize it.
Given she's the only elected person who's going to be running, it'll be hard to argue against that. I'm sure we will see other people in the race. But yeah, she was pretty influential in the... allegedly, according to, you know, the book Matter of Confidence, in the Greens' decision to side with the NDP over the BC Liberals. It's not to say I think she's in the like eco-socialist wing of the Greens, but I think she's definitely more on the center-left side of them. Anything you're looking for in her campaign?
Well, just kind of that, where she wants to take the party compared to how Andrew Weaver's managed it. And yeah, like you said, she's a lot less liberal-friendly, I think both in terms of temperament in general, as well as just feelings towards the organization.
Yeah, we'll definitely be keeping our eyes on her campaign and extending invitations to her to come on the podcast at some point, as well as anyone else who wants to lead the BC Greens.
Or the Federal Greens, too, for that matter. If you're running for leadership, we'll do an interview with you.
Yeah. Well, the other news in BC politics this week, the Wet'suwet'en protests continue to be in the news against the Coastal GasLink pipeline. I think we want to shout out two stories this week. First, from BC Today, and you can read this at politicstoday.news, Shannon Waters has a really interesting results of a Freedom of Information request that documents the government's internal thinking around how to respond to this. So she has reports of how they decided who to side with, who to call, and, you know, how they decided to bring on Murray Rankin, which is a really interesting story. So just take a look at that in the show notes. It's interesting.
And the other news is that the BC government's appointed Nathan Cullen in Murray Rankin's place, now that Murray Rankin is no longer in that role.
It's unclear what Murray Rankin's doing, because he's still assisting the government, but he was supposedly never really working directly on the Coastal GasLink pipeline question. He was just helping the government build better relations with First Nations in the North, I guess. But Nathan Cullen will be the one responsible for trying to smooth over this current controversy. It is an interesting kind of make-work project for ex-elected New Democrats, Rankin and Cullen both being former federal MPs. Rankin is reportedly working pro bono to the government, but I'm not clear about Cullen. And Cullen also announced earlier this week or recently that he was taking up a job with a strategic communications firm. So, yeah, if you're in Parliament long enough and you build up a good reputation, there's lots of opportunities that come knocking. But while the NDP government here in BC is having success with finding and appointing ex-New Democrat politicians, one Liberal that they had appointed, Blair Leckstrom, has quit his post. He was appointed by the Premier to help deal with some of the ongoing disputes about what to do about declining caribou populations in the North. And he had come to a number of recommendations with local communities. And in Leckstrom's words, the government only took up one of those recommendations. And so he feels like this was a pointless exercise, and he's left that role. I mean, it's kind of, in some ways, feels inevitable when you appoint your political rivals to these, like...
You know, the BC Liberals have a lot of representation connections up in that part of the province, so it does kind of make sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's going to be some tension, for sure.
And the caribou question's a complicated and important one for the North, and having someone who has those connections is worth getting in there, but those tensions are deep, and trying to patch them over doesn't always work, so... Hopefully, you know, we can move forward on this.
Well, one thing the government is looking at is changing some of the agricultural land reserve rules to allow a second residence to be built on farmland, if local governments also grant approval for this. So this would allow farmers to basically have a smaller secondary residence on their farmland. Seems reasonable.
Yeah, this comes amid a lot of debate in Richmond in particular, but also some other parts of the province where there is a lot of agricultural land reserve, but it's also in the middle of Metro Vancouver where there's a housing crisis. And so people are looking at this land being like both the owners of it and, you know, neighboring communities going, what if I built something bigger there and had someone live in it? And there have been a few portions of the ALR where people have been accused of building mega mansions or overbuilding their houses. And it raised the question of, you know, what can and what should be done with this land? Because we do, I think, have a fairly strong consensus that we want to maintain farmland in the province, particularly the valuable farmland in the Lower Mainland. And I think this is the government attempting to try to find a balance. So it's not saying go to town, build whatever you want, but it's saying if there's some buy-in, you can have a small secondary residence, and it is pitching this as either a manufactured home, sort of a mobile home of a certain size, a garden suite, guest house, sort of carriage suite, or some other type of small structure that it notes doesn't have to be just for family use. It could be rented out effectively, it seems like. This is just an intentions paper, so they are seeking feedback, but it'll be interesting because this could be a slight shift in where we go with ALR.
Yeah, because there were some policy moves, I think, both by the Richmond government and the provincial government. My memory's a little fuzzy on this one, to limit those mega mansions. But yeah, this does seem a way to kind of at least very modestly let off a bit of the pent-up pressure for housing there.
Well, one of the other places the government is considering some changes is over at ICBC, where they're still struggling to get costs under control and really support auto insurance purchasers, which is quite a few people in the province. David Eby was announcing this morning a boosted, quote, fairness commissioner that will be, quote, supercharged. So ICBC apparently already does have a fairness commissioner, someone whose job is to adjudicate disputes and complaints about how reasonable ICBC is being. There have been no shortage of, you know, criticisms of the agency. And the goal here is to make this office more independent, give it a bigger budget, and mandate an obligation that ICBC respond to decisions by this commissioner. This kind of falls in a like classic consumer protection angle that the NDP has long had as a party. Also, the term fairness commissioner still comes off as Orwellian to me in a weird way.
Yeah, it does have that weird vibe to it. Not sure there's any way around it.
That doesn't mean it's a bad idea. It's also not totally clear how much this will help. I mean, hopefully if they're obligated to respond, then if they're found to be acting unfairly, they will have to be more fair. Who's against fairness, Scott?
Well, I think the main criticism that we saw in the way to this, and this was only just announced today, was that doesn't really get at the increased ICBC costs, which has been the Liberals' main point of attack on the government on the ICBC file.
Yeah, part of that was pushed this week, especially because the Insurance Bureau of Canada released a report which argues that private insurance would bring down the cost for BC drivers. Now, the Insurance Bureau of Canada is a lobby group that represents private insurers, so it's kind of like the independent school associations plumping up the value of independent schools, or any interest group talking up their interests.
Yeah, and we kind of let her try. It's been a couple of years since I looked at this, but Canada really varies depending on the province where public or private insurance comes in. Like, I was paying less for private insurance in New Brunswick, but I was paying more in Ontario. So there's a lot of things that go into it, and it's not necessarily the case that one automatically leads to the other.
Yeah, there are provinces with private insurance that are both cheap and expensive, and there are provinces with fully public systems that are both cheap and expensive. And a lot of it comes down to just how claims are being adjudicated and a lot of the minutiae around that. And it seems like in BC, it's gotten really out of hand in terms of payouts and things like that. And that's what some of the actions the province has tried to take have been tackling. But they've also run into trouble where, trying to limit the number of expert witnesses runs up against that darn blasted charter and people's right to a fair trial. There has also been...
Yeah, and you could see like a private company, depending on what the regulations and laws that would be brought in to enable that, could, try and clamp down on those costs a little more, but it's really going to depend on kind of what the enabling legislation is going to be.
Yeah, but this is definitely something the BC Liberals have taken square aim at and said, we will fix it by bringing in private insurance and then you don't have to worry, your costs will go down. But I think the government's responding with some internal studies suggesting that might be true in some cases, but in other cases, riskier drivers might be, younger drivers especially, might be much worse off in such a situation because right now they get the large pool effect of a public option. So,
although with some of the restructuring that's happened this past year, that's not quite as... Like, young drivers are definitely getting hit a lot harder under the new rules.
I think the key point is ICBC is a mess and there's not a simple solution, and anyone who tells you there is, whether it's a fairness commissioner or private insurance, is wrong. But things are moving forward. We'll see if they manage to bring that deficit down as much as they've been hoping to.
And finally, a quick follow-up to last week's announcement of Uber and Lyft coming to Metro Vancouver. Surrey has, I think, dominated the headlines on the reaction to that, as they've been actively trying to clamp down on Uber Lyft, handing out tickets. Mayor McCollum's, on a crusade practically against Uber and Lyft.
Yeah, it's bizarre how obsessed he is with this.
But... Yeah, so Surrey bylaw officers are hailing Uber and Lyft rides and then handing them $500 tickets as soon as they show up.
Now, does not seem like a priority, honestly, to me. Even if I don't like these companies.
It's probably not the biggest challenge Surrey has with their bylaws.
Yeah, and the people who are driving is not the problem I have with these ride-hailing companies. They're just trying to make a little bit of extra money. Go after the company, not the driver, if you're going to go after something.
Yeah, when Claire Trevino was asked about this, she basically said it's up to the companies to sue Surrey to sort this out, which they have announced they're going to be going forward, trying to get an injunction on them.
Yeah, so, 9 Metro Vancouver cab companies came together and have filed a legal challenge.
Different.
Oh, that's a different lawsuit.
Yes, this is Uber and Lyft going to go challenge Surrey's ability to block Uber and Lyft despite the provincial legislation not really giving them the option. Because the way it works is that municipalities can license them, but if there isn't a licensing system in the municipality, the Passenger Transportation Board's rules govern.
I think it's mostly a problem for Uber. I think the initial service zone of Lyft is just like as big as the Mobi bike share network zone is.
Yeah, with like 2 pockets for YVR and the P&E.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see where this is going. In terms of the cab companies, they have their lawsuit, but there's also this weird action by the BC Taxi Association, which is that they've announced that they're going to stop providing funding for accessible options because the ride-hailing companies are not mandated to provide accessible options. They're just putting money into a pot that's not clear where it's going. And, like, I get that that is unfair and there should be some clarity about where that money is going and what it's doing, but I feel like this is, like...
It's trying to play hardball.
Well, and it's using disabled people's bodies and transportation for it, which is gross. Like, there's a lot of job action and, like, protest and creativity that I... I'm all good with. That's all interesting. But when the pawns you're using are people who don't have other options of getting around, that doesn't feel right. It's just one of those situations where I kind of hate everyone involved. Build more trains. I know that doesn't solve everything, but...
One thing we don't actually have in here is that, never mind, that's a Cambie Report thing.
We'll save it for Cambie Report. I'm sure we'll have lots more to talk about Uber and Lyft on that podcast. Check it out. Well, now let's jump over to our next segment, which is the interview I recorded earlier this week with some of the people behind the Access BC campaign. They're calling on the government of BC to provide free contraceptives as a way to expand our healthcare system. And I'll throw it over to that to let them explain why. All right. Joining me over Zoom is Dr. Teal Phelps Bondaroff and Bree Gardner from the Access BC campaign. Bree, just to start us off, what is Access BC?
Yeah, Access BC is a 2-year-old campaign that was started by Devin Black and Teal, who's on the line with us. I got involved a little more than a year ago, and we've been basically lobbying to get contraception care free for everyone in BC.
And so the idea is to have just the government pay for everyone's contraceptives?
That's correct. So because we live in a country that values free healthcare, and that's a complicated thing to say because it's not always true, this is one of those areas where healthcare isn't actually free for very many people unless you have, health insurance or some sort of means-tested government support. A lot of people don't have access to contraception and, in this case, contraception means IUDs, birth control. There's a couple different options, injections as well.
Would this be just bowls of condoms on the street?
It would not be bowls of condoms on the street. That already exists. It would be about prescription contraception.
And so, Teal, you helped found this campaign. What motivated you to kind of get involved in this line of research or activism?
Yeah, so the background is really, I was living in the UK and the United Kingdom doing my grad school. And in the United Kingdom, all prescription contraception is free. And as a result, when I moved back to British Columbia, I was very surprised to find that that was not the case. And when you start looking into it, there are lots of barriers that people face when trying to access prescription contraception in BC. And those barriers have huge impacts on people. So if you can't access contraception or the more expensive methods tend to be the more reliable methods, then you may or you're at advanced risk of having unplanned pregnancies. And, unplanned pregnancies can derail people's lives. They can have high personal costs. They have higher risk of negative health impacts, and they're higher risk for the mother and child, and they cost our healthcare system more. So when you start looking into it, you see all these barriers that are preventing people from accessing contraception and all the benefits to removing those barriers. And so, for example, an IUD, an intrauterine device, can cost as much as $75 for some of the copper versions or $380 for the hormonal ones. Contraceptive pills are $20 a month sometimes, and injections can be as much as $180 a year. And those costs can be prohibitive to some folks. And all the research indicates that when you remove cost, people turn to the more reliable methods. So as Bree mentioned, there are condoms freely available. If you can't find them, please go to a local health clinic. They will give you free condoms. But the fact that, you know, I can get access to free condoms, but someone with a uterus can't get access to an IUD for free is both an equity issue, a health issue, and surprisingly, one thing that we found, and the research has indicated, is that it's costing society more money. So these programs that offer free prescription contraception have been found to save governments money. A 2010 study from Options for Sexual Health found or calculated that a similar program would save British Columbia as much as $90 million in direct medical savings. So not only does this help health outcomes, equity, it also saves money for both people and the government.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's something that comes up with a lot of programs. It's particularly behind the $10 a day childcare. I know getting people in childcare then frees up people to work. And so there's a lot of knock-on effects of these.
Yeah, those are some of the consequences, as you see, of, say, unplanned pregnancy, right? It's not just the direct medical costs, say, spending time in the hospital. It's paying to raise a child. And glibly, we say in the campaign that if you can't afford contraception, you probably also can't afford to raise a child. But that kind of skates over some of the broader impacts that unplanned pregnancy can have on someone's life. You know, you may be forced to drop out of school, which reduces your earning potential. Or you might stay in an unhealthy relationship, you know, for the air quotes sake of the child. And all those kinds of things sort of compound. And honestly, you know, when I said that the United Kingdom did this policy, that's not the only country that has. You know, you see countries across Europe and the world looking to remove barriers to contraception, and it has huge benefits.
So what drew you, Bree, to this campaign?
Yeah, I mean, so I've known Teal and Devin for years, so that's definitely part of it. But also, I'm an abortion doula. And so part of the work that I do is listening to the stories of all of the people who come to access my services because they need help finding a way to get an abortion. And some of these people are incredibly high risk. Some of them are, you know, just not able to access medical systems or not willing to access normal medical systems without proper support. But the amount of people that I've worked with, even in the short time that I've lived in BC, which has only been a year, and before that in Alberta, you know, the cost of not being able to access contraception before you're, you know, faced with a different choice is, it's really high. And really quite shocking.
So one of the things we were talking about just before we started recording is the number of groups coming behind this campaign. Is this just the handful of people behind Access BC, or is there a movement here?
I can jump in here briefly.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so we started off as a very small group of people, as all old school grassroots movements do in our living room, discussing you know, strategy and how we wanted to go about the policy. And the history of the campaign is we started with about a year of behind-the-scenes lobbying and meeting with politicians and ministers. And after some time, the message that we received was, this is a good policy. It's one that's supported by BCNDP, for example. They passed a motion at their 2017 convention. It's one that's been endorsed by the Greens. Adam Olson endorsed it. But what they needed was more pressure from the public. So last year in January, we launched a letter-writing campaign. And that's been very successful. We've had thousands of letters pouring in from across the province. But also part of that was coalition building. And we wanted to build an alliance of people who support this cause. And so people can visit our website at accessbc.org and see our growing list of allies. I was just saying that this morning we announced, we're announcing a joint statement with the UBC Medical Undergraduate Society. We're doing a joint statement next week with the Canadian Federation of Medical Students. And we've seen a lot of support, particularly from young people, because they are very much more acutely affected by this than other folks, because they are the ones that are bearing the brunt of the affordability crisis. But we're also seeing a lot of support across the field. So we've had endorsements from the Vancouver and Victoria Labor Councils. We've had support from various students' unions, and as well as different groups like abortion collectives. And we're very excited that the BCGEU is getting on board, as well as the Raging Grannies. So it's a wide range of people that recognize the benefits of the policy. And that's the calls here in British Columbia, but we're not the only ones making this call. We've increasingly seen people in the medical field calling for increased access to prescription contraception. The Canadian Medical Association's released a statement, the Society for Obstetricians and Gynecologists of Canada, the Canadian Pediatric Society have all stated affirmatively that free prescription contraception is a great policy for health and has strong evidence of support as a good policy.
One of your calls is for no-cost contraception in the 2020 budget, but you note there might be a need for a more targeted approach. Bree, can you maybe elaborate on maybe why it's valuable to target people 25 and under if that's all the government's willing to do?
Right. So From a campaign perspective, I think that making everything universally available for any age range for any reason is the ideal. That's what we're going for with XSBC. And that being said, the government recommendation was to have, if not universal access, to have those under the age of 25. So the under the age of 25 is awesome for a number of reasons, one of which is those folks tend to not have as much disposable income. So accessing it generally is more difficult, as well as there's a really interesting barrier when it comes to the stigma related to contraception, where you, as a youth, can't necessarily talk about it with your parents. And that's for a number of different reasons. Maybe, you know, you're not in a safe household. Maybe you're in a religious household. Maybe you don't want to have that conversation with your parents because you're worried about some of the ramifications that might have. And so making it free for those under 25 releases them from needing to give up their privacy in order to access the human right that is, you know, being able to choose what to do with your body and your life and the way in which you're proceeding in the world.
And just to jump in here, well, when Bree's referring to the government recommendations, what they're talking about is the budget consultation this summer in August. We participated in that process as a stakeholder, and our recommendation was accepted. It's recommendation number 50. But the caveat was added to it that the government would explore a targeted and incremental approach. We've always advocated universal access because as soon as you have any barrier, whether it's age or income or geography, you're excluding people, they're falling through the cracks, and it's unjust. It also costs more for bureaucracy, for that matter. And so the government accepted the policy, but they did say it might be incremental and targeted. And so as a result, we anticipate the government might start exploring options like targeting this policy for younger folks. And this is something that's been done in other jurisdictions. Ontario had a policy for a while. And various countries in Europe have tried targeting to specifically young people. And as I mentioned earlier, these are the people who are feeling the brunt of the affordability crisis. And we were up at UVic last week, and we were tabling and talking to folks, and you know, the stories that we heard were that there are young people that are acutely impacted by this, whether it's, you know, you change your degree program and suddenly you're not covered under your health plan, and you want to protect your privacy from your parents, or just you don't have the money to afford it because, you know, housing is incredibly expensive and so is school. So there's all these different reasons why young people are acutely affected. So if you were a government looking to try targeted and incremental policy, you might try just targeting it towards younger folks.
Well, I think that covers all the questions I had. Assuming you've convinced our listeners, what should they do to help?
Yeah, so for the past year, we've been running a letter writing campaign, encouraging people to reach out to their MLAs to tell them to include this in the budget. And we have about a week left on that campaign. So we're encouraging people, whenever they hear this podcast, to hop on our website at accessbc.org, where they can fill out a very quick letter to ask their MLA to make all prescription contraception universally available at no cost. After the budget, we'd encourage people to stay tuned. Depending on what's included in the budget, we're going to explore our next steps. And that can be a myriad of different strategies and approaches. And as Bree mentioned, cost is not the only barrier to accessing contraception in BC. It's the low-hanging fruit. It's the easiest one to deal with. But there's a wide range of compounding other barriers. Mm-hmm. So for example, actually, Bree, do you want to maybe some elaborate on this? Because I think it's one of the critical things people forget, that cost is just one of the many barriers that people face when trying to access prescription contraception.
Yeah, it's really important to remember that, like, cost is the end of the day kind of last rung on this adventure into accessing healthcare. For many of us who are maybe disabled or maybe trans or maybe low income, of which I am all, the compounding barriers is like this catchphrase that we've been using in the campaign to try to explain how cost is just one easy thing to fix. And things that are not so easy to fix are like rural communities who don't have access to doctors, so they can't get the prescription. And maybe they have to spend money on a cab trying to get somewhere into a different town that does have a doctor, and then spending all day talking to that doctor. Maybe they need childcare for their existing children, so that's expensive. We look at people who are trying to leave generations of poverty, who are not able to without, you know, good access to contraception. Maybe it's a trans person who has a uterus, has the ability to get pregnant, but because of their hormones, their doctor is unwilling or unable to understand the needs of their bodies enough to provide access, or perhaps the understanding of safety that it is required to even get that trans person into a doctor in the first place. I know that as abortion doula, I see a lot of trans mass people who come to me because they don't have a safe doctor to go to. There are other ones, you know, you can talk about how with means testing, you need to be able to prove your low income status or your disability status, which is actually quite a long and bureaucratic and frustrating process of which there is little to no information about how to do. So you're navigating the system on your own, by yourself, without a lot of education and with already a lot of things in the background that are quite challenging. So that's why it's important, especially to like do the universal version and not the targeted one, because it does leave out people such as those. But it's also important to remember that even youth, like all of us, everyone exists in a complicated relationship with reality and complicated relationship with the world. And so the financial aspect of it is just the easiest one for Access BC to fix. Like, we can't fix transphobia, we can't fix poverty, we can't fix sexism, but we can fix like saving the government money provincially, annually, to provide free healthcare, which also saves people, you know, an immense amount of hardship that comes from trying to pay for it.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the stories that one of our members told us, she grew up outside of a 100-mile house, and in order to access an IUD, she would have to hitchhike from her home into town to get a prescription filled, and then hitchhike home, and then on another day, hitchhike back into the clinic to get the IUD inserted. Now, this is in an incredibly dangerous strip of highway where, you know, we see missing, murdered Indigenous women occurring. And so that person is literally taking their life potentially in their hands to access contraception. And then they face a direct cost when they show up at the clinic. You know, these are all the kinds of things that people face every day. And as Bree mentioned, and as we've said a few times, this is a policy that increases health outcomes. It saves the government money. And it's about equity and equality, right? I think I've purchased maybe two boxes of condoms in my entire life, but you know, an IUD costs $380, and that's simply a matter of justice as well. So even if this policy did cost more money, which it doesn't, we should do it anyways to maximize health outcomes and promote equality.
I think that covers everything. I think it's a very good campaign. I'm all behind it. Mm-hmm. Accessbc.org. Is there anything else we didn't touch on?
Actually, I think that covers everything. I think, Bree, do you have anything you wanted to add?
No, I always love talking about compounding barriers. As long as we get that in, I'm happy.
Yeah, it's interesting. Bree taught me that line, that way of framing it. And it kind of opens your eyes because, you know, as a non-uterus having person, I don't really appreciate all those kinds of different barriers. I did teach sex ed for a few years, and stigma is also a barrier that comes up a lot. And it's really hard to conceptualize that someone might have to take, you know, risk their safety to go access contraception. That is always, it's mind-boggling, and it's something we need to fight against.
Yeah.
All right, Teal and Bree, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Yeah, cheers.
Well, moving on to the roundup for the Chef du Parti Conservateur, or the Conservative Party's leadership race. This week, I think the...
Or as the Conservatives call it, Chefferie Conservatrice de Milvent.
So neither of our French are really good enough to know which one is the correct, or...
The one I took is, I didn't pronounce it right, obviously, but I took it from the Conservative Party's French website. And when I direct translate that, it means the Conservative Chiefdom 2020, which feels apt. Again, we don't have strong Canadian French, so maybe that's not the exact translation. Conservative leadership, bilingualism, is in the debate this week.
Yes. So this is... being kind of what the big national story or conversation has been around the leadership race. It's been going on for a couple weeks now. I think it really felt like it came to a head this week after Peter McKay's big announcement event had him mangling the little bit of French on his teleprompter, which, yeah, didn't go over particularly well and prompted a round of, well, does it matter if a national party leader doesn't actually speak French or even just passable enough French?
Yeah, you have links in here from Rosemary Barton writing in CBC that prime ministers should be fluently bilingual versus Chris Selly in the National Post and Ken White in the Globe and Mail arguing, we didn't always require bilingualism in our prime ministers, and maybe it's time that's not necessary since the Conservatives don't do well in Quebec anyway.
Yeah, so I mainly want to talk about this from the BC perspective. But before we get into it, I think there's kind of a broader point that should be said, that just as a general rule, you don't want to come off as disrespecting about a quarter of the electorate and not learning one of the official languages isn't all, you know, it's arguably pretty disrespectful towards Francophone Canadians.
And given they are centralized in a region, Quebec primarily, it makes them influential under our first-past-the-post system. Now, notably, none of the recent conservative governments have built much into Quebec, I think.
Well, Mulroney was the last conservative to really win in Quebec.
But the Harper government, and the Harper government era managed to show you can build an Ontario West coalition to have enough seats where, you know, you pick up 10 or 15 in Quebec.
I think they got 10 or so.
And then you have a government, even a majority government for one term.
Yeah, so there are some demographic shifts that are decreasing Quebec's relative importance electorally in Canada. But at the same time, like, even if most Ontarians aren't bilingual, I think there's a general sense out there that a prime ministerial candidate needs to be bilingual just as something that needs to happen in Canada.
And that's the thing. I think a party and its leader can even say, you know, we don't need to be bilingual. But in that situation, you're going to have the media and Canadian and a lot of Canadians spending a lot of time talking about that rather than the policies you want to run on or literally anything else. Because if you're having to try and continually make the case that, no, it's fine that I just speak English or English and not French, then you're not talking about why the Liberals are bad or why flat taxes are good if you're Rick Peterson or any number of other things.
It's not going to be Rick Peterson.
No.
Why is he even in this one again?
Something to do.
Yeah, so that's, I think, kind of the national picture. And for practical reasons, political reasons, however you want to classify it, I think as a general rule, leaders need to be bilingual. But that also has some of its own challenges and drawbacks with it, particularly with relation to Western Canada, where, you know, in this case, a lot of the potential conservative leaders come from, and where French just really isn't all that common. So 6.8% of British Columbians, 6.6% of Albertans. So relatively small amounts of people outside of central Canada are bilingual. And that's probably will be even lower than that if you really actually challenged people on that. And that has its, I mean, that means the potential pool of people who could be prime minister or serve on the Supreme Court or a bunch of other federal institutions that are bilingual is limited.
And there are other languages that are quite common, particularly here in BC.
Yeah, French Chinese is about the fifth or sixth mm-hmm. most commonly spoken language.
Yeah, and so there's arguments that if you're going to represent BC, French isn't the most valuable second language.
Well, I think just on election signs, you're more likely to see Chinese than French.
Yeah, and in different neighborhoods, maybe Farsi is valuable, or maybe an indigenous language even. There are quite a few of those in BC, but...
And that's, I think, key is that functionally Canada isn't a bilingual country. Like, if you aggregate it at the, you know, 20,000-foot view, it kind of is. But if you start looking at the various... at Canada in a little more detail, it's really a country of unilingual regions with some areas of bilingualism on the borders.
I mean, most countries that are officially multilingual are kind of like that. Switzerland is officially four languages. French is spoken mostly in Geneva. And then...
yeah, and you have like Belgium, which is half and half Dutch and French. There's a bunch of European countries on that. Though it's a lot easier when you're in a much more geographically contained area. Because we are actually closer to Mexico than Quebec right now. That's how big Canada is. And it's just kind of different when you're thousands of kilometers away from, you know, the major Francophone population.
I wonder if you could almost have a party, and it might be another way to do it, as with a dual leadership situation where you have your English Canada leader and your French Canada leader.
Well, in the articles that you mentioned earlier, that was kind of what they pointed to, is back before it was just expected that leaders were bilingual, they would have a Quebec lieutenant and who would represent the party to Quebecers.
And a lot of parties still even do that when their leader is bilingual. Jagmeet Singh has appointed Alexandre Boulouris as not just the only Quebec MP, but the NDP's lieutenant in Quebec. It's just nice. They like to be recognized as a distinct nation, and that's mm-hmm. reasonable.
Yeah, but I think getting back to what we were talking about is that it's just generally pretty hard to develop a fluency in another language when you just don't have that immersion. And that does present limitations for how Westerners can interact with the higher levels of political power in Canada. And, you know, that's going to bias towards people from higher socioeconomic classes where, you know, there are those resources where you're more likely to have access to French immersion education. And, I mean, I'm not sure if there's a good solution to this because, I mean, I took French through part of my school and then later on at RMC, and I think my French is probably better than yours, but it's gotten a lot rustier since in the like 5-6 years since I ever was using it, even on an occasional basis.
Yeah, I did one class of French from grade 4 till grade 9, but a lot of those classes were not very serious. We watched a lot of Tintin and other videos that did not sink in.
Yeah, my experience in BC was somewhat similar where I swear we learned the same vocabulary like 4 years in a row.
That's because they're trying to make it stick, and because you're not speaking it regularly, it just doesn't.
Yeah, but that's the challenge. You're just not speaking it regularly, and it fades if you don't actively use it. So it becomes a situation where basically, unless you're, you know, setting your sights on, you know, a Supreme Court seat or Prime Minister, there isn't really the impetus or the option really to learn it in a lot of cases.
Maybe we'll have universal translators soon enough. Google's getting there.
It's actually pretty impressive. Like, yeah, there's some stuff with real-time conversation that I haven't paid too much attention to, but like the thing, you can just hold it up and with the camera and it'll translate signage and everything for the most part. Yeah, computerized translation may solve this problem, but in the meantime, yeah, it's going to be a challenge, and I'm not sure if there's an easy way to reconcile just the need to be bilingual with the barriers that it presents to Western Canadians.
Well, with that, let's look at some of the people who may face that barrier as they ponder a bid for the Conservative leadership. Candace Bergen is the most prominent name among the new round to put herself forward as a potential leadership candidate. Notably, she is a sitting MP right now, but she is also not bilingual. So if that becomes a deciding factor, she might not be sticking around for it.
Yeah, I think you can win the Conservative Party leadership race without being bilingual. It's still going to be a challenge because, especially now in a minority situation, they're going to be looking for electability. But like, it is still quite a Western-based party, and while that's attenuated a bit by the voting system they have, by and large, I think probably your average Conservative Party member isn't going to be particularly concerned, at least on a personal level, with bilingualism, even if there's arguments like the ones I made that they agree with about needing to be bilingual. It might not be quite the thing that ultimately motivates votes.
Well, and the other two names coming forward this week are New Brunswick MP John Williamson, who I honestly know nothing about other than that he's from New Brunswick.
Yes, the English part of New Brunswick, though. Southern New Brunswick.
New Brunswick is actually the only officially bilingual province.
Although it has a lower bilingualism rate than Quebec.
It's a province of two unilingual areas. And then finally, Cambridge, Ontario lawyer Jim Karahelios has announced he wants to seek the leadership. He is married to Ontario Conservative MPP Belinda Karahelios, and I honestly can't say much else about him, but I'll throw a link to it in the show notes. And then I figured we'd touch on what the candidates are doing. I mentioned Rick Peterson. He announced his flat tax rate and is going for a like Maxime Bernier policy book type race this time, maybe just to stand out more than he did last time.
That's a low bar to cross. but it's all about being bold, I guess.
You got to get noticed. He did get a headline out of it. But more interestingly, we talked last week about how Aaron O'Toole and Peter MacKay would distinguish themselves, because in 2017, Aaron O'Toole came in fourth, but seemed to take
third.
He finished right behind
Bernier.
Yeah, he did quite well. But he took this kind of centrist line of, you know, let's not be too extreme right. He wasn't the full like red Tory, but he was closer to that. This year, he's taken a much different track, trying to go true blue, in his words, and he really wants to tackle cancel culture and the radical left, which to me are like the buzzwords of the Jordan Peterson base, which I don't actually hope is that big.
So like those are, like, I don't think that's actually too far outside of where a lot of conservatives are. So like it's pretty, I think, middle of the road for the party. And while it's, I think, raises eyebrows out from people outside of conservative circles, it's not leaning into it as much as it could be. And I wonder how much of this is just kind of, you know, put out some early indications that he's positioned himself to McKay's right, you know, just kind of signal that, okay, yeah, I hear your concerns, before focusing more on kind of a traditional, slightly righter PC.
Yeah, I think part of it was the video he released shows him as a bit angrier, more boisterous than the previous leadership race. You know, when he's talking about these cancel culture type things, he's showing the attempts to pull down John A. McDonald's statues. And
actually pretty outspoken about it when the statue came down in Victoria. So like, it's not entirely a surprise that he's doing that. And wanting to keep the John A. McDonald statue up is a pretty mainstream view within the Conservative Party. So,
oh yeah, it's definitely popular
among... In fact, it's not just the Conservative Party. Like, it's, don't actually know if there's any polling done on it, but my perception is that it's popular with probably at least half of the country, if not more.
And there's an age divide on that. I think the older generation that's more keen to vote conservative and especially hold a Conservative Party membership is more enraged by that than...
Yeah, but like there's probably liberals, there's probably even members of like the Green Party and stuff who like, if you ask them without like priming them on their political on their, you know, partisan identification, would probably express some reservations about that sort of thing.
So it'll be interesting to see how this kind of goes between O'Toole and McKay. McKay announced this week also in his kind of positioning that he will apply to march in the Toronto Pride Parade. Now it'll be hilarious if they reject him and they say, sorry, we don't let conservatives in until your party's less homophobic, which Pride Parades have done. But, you know, he's trying to make the statement that I'm going to put those social conservative things in the past and be more open to this than Scheer was.
I think O'Toole's made similar comments. Like, I think there's, as much as you're not going to get away from some of the culture war stuff, I think there's definitely an urge to move beyond that when it comes to LGBTQ issues, at least among the front runners. There's, of course, a few no names who are kind of vying for the social conservative lane, but so far no one's really emerged there, and none of them are coming in with, I think, enough name recognition or kind of clout to really be worth discussing too much at this point, and at least until that lane coalesces around a single candidate.
Yeah. Well, the only other thing noteworthy in the Conservative Party this week is Andrew Scheer was in the news kind of talking about the follow-up of the review of their party's performance in the 2019 election. Now, that review is not going to be public, as most internal party documents never are, but the media did get the chance to ask him, you know, what about all this private school stuff, funding stuff, that seemed like it was why you had to quit the party in such a rush? And he just declined to comment on it, saying it's a personal matter and doesn't want to deal with that. Which I think was also the problem he had a lot during the election, was any time like his integrity kind of came up in question, he just kind of shrunk and like ran away from reporters, and that only made them want to ask about it more. I don't think we're going to find out anything more about the private school funding. This was the fact he was using party funds to put his kids into private school, which may or may not have been above board.
Well, moving on to quick takes, we'll jump in with the Green Party federal races roundup. So the rules are going to be announced February 3rd, so we should be able to discuss that on NetSuite's episode. But in the meantime, three new people have put their names forward. Anna Mee Paul from Toronto, who's hoping to become the first black woman to lead a party.
Yeah, she's a...
A federal party, that is.
Yes.
Actually, provincially. I actually don't know. I should know that, but I'm not sure.
So she's the party's current global affairs critic. She's a lawyer. Looks interesting. I want to hear more from her. Rosemary Brown notably came the closest to becoming a Black federal political leader when she tried to make the jump from the BC legislature to run in the federal NDP. She almost beat Ed Broadbent when he won in 1975, which was unexpected because I think she didn't fully intend to. I read her memoir about this. It was really interesting. So we'll spend a different time on that. But Annamie Paul would be an interesting Green Party leader, but no elected experience. Now, none of the candidates have elected experience in the race. One of the other people seeking the nomination is Judy Green, the former candidate from West Nova. I believe she is a health food salesperson.
So the CBC article lists her as a wellness and food nutrition worker, which is vague and also very on brand for the Green Party.
And in the same article, it mentions Constantine Kritsonis, who was the former candidate in York Center. And there's not much else said about him.
And finally, Julie Tremblay-Trottier, Quebec businesswoman and also a former Liberal.
Yeah, and former candidate from Mirabel. So more who kind of names than the federal conservatives, but...
Wait, that's to be expected,
given
just because they don't have really much of a caucus with any history behind it.
And still a lot of questions to be seen about how these different candidates position themselves and how they want to take the federal Greens, which are now a caucus of three, in new or the same direction. Just quickly jumping back to the Senate, which we haven't had a chance to touch in on in a while, we noted at the end of last year that the government representatives in the Senate, the people tasked with getting the government legislation through the Senate, had all resigned and decided to be independents or join one of the independent caucuses. So the government needed to find a new senator, and they've now named Mark Gold, a constitutional law expert and former chair of the Jewish Federation of Canada, as the government's representative in the upper chamber. So we'll see if he's able to do more effectively what I think the Trudeau Liberals struggled with in the last parliament.
And a follow-up to our conversation with Kevin Milligan, the PBO, the Parliamentary Budget Office, has figured out how much the Liberals plan to raise the basic personal amount is going to cost, and it's going to be about $21 billion over 5 years, starting with about $780 million this year and rising all the way up to about $6.8 billion by the 2023-2024 fiscal year. So, like, it's something. It's about little under a third of a percent of the budget, roughly.
That's like $4 billion a year when you average it out. Like, that's enough to do some serious program.
Yeah.
You can get PharmaCare started with that and do a big chunk of it. It's all about priorities. That's what government is. But while we're talking about priorities and spending, it's come out that as a follow-up to a number of stories we covered last year, the government's efforts to prosecute Mark Norman, the former vice admiral, for allegedly leaking secrets, the government spent $1.4 million in legal costs in that case that they ultimately dropped.
The one that looked to be pretty much politically motivated more than anything else.
Choices. It's all about choices when you're in government.
So no doubt the opposition parties are going to try and make a little hay about that. But I think the Mark Norman stuff probably doesn't have much legs to it anymore politically. But I don't know. We'll see if anything else comes out on this. Because that is a lot of money to just throw at a... I mean, it's small potatoes in the grand scheme of how much the federal government spends. But for what more or less seems like a political vendetta, it's a lot of money. And finally, the panel that the federal government put together to look at Canadian content, the future of the CBC, has come back with a bunch of recommendations. So this was a panel on broadcast reforms, and it's looking at everything from how the government should deal with CanCon content on Netflix to whether or not the CBC should be ad-free. Recommends ad-free CBC.
Good.
As well as reimagining how the CRTC works by expanding its jurisdiction to include all media providers, including online curators.
Does that mean us? That might mean us.
It's a good question.
It's vague.
Yeah. I'm not sure if podcasts really should fall under the CRTC jurisdiction.
I think it's talking about online curators, which elsewhere in the report are deemed like Netflix and
right.
The big ones, but... that's the kind of questions that get raised. And, you know, I only saw this report come out this afternoon, but I do want to go deeper in it. I'm sure Canada Land's going to do its take that it likes some of this. It dislikes anything that says give money to independent journalism, but this actually says to do that. It imagines expanding the tax credits the government has announced for newspapers, the bailouts, to make those, quote, platform agnostic, and to make sure they're available to people, whether they're independent or broadcast or affiliated.
Which is true, because those are the big criticisms of the last one. It was pretty much just the Post Media and the three other companies that own every newspaper bailout.
Yeah, I mean, we want some money too. Maybe. We'll see.
So yeah, and the CanCon content on Netflix is no doubt going to be controversial. And not to mention, just a little odd, because the way it's conceptualized just doesn't really make much sense for the modern on-demand streaming services.
Well, it's asking Netflix to potentially do, and similar streamers, it doesn't name Netflix specifically in the recommendations, but to do two things. Number one, invest a fixed certain amount of money in developing Canadian content, which I think Netflix is actually doing voluntarily already, but it's just whether it's officially CanCon or not. But then also, they might force companies to play with their algorithms in Canada to make sure that that content isn't being buried, which is really going to upset some of those companies.
Yeah, that's not going to be popular. And I'm not sure the government should really be mandating how companies do those sort of recommendation algorithms.
Know what I'd rather see? I'd rather see the government just set up a universal platform distribution that just amalgamates all that content, so I don't have to buy 8 different services.
So yeah, it doesn't become like cable used to be.
Yeah. It doesn't have to create content. It just has to take the content that's out there and let me buy it for one price and aggregate it.
Yeah, it would be nice if the CanCon was more, or Canadian content was more focused on just producing quality stuff that people want to watch, because there are stuff that has followings internationally because it's just good content, but there's also a lot that's just kind of there to fill out stuff, and it would be much nicer if we could work more on, having more, Letterkenny's and Schitt's Creek and whatnot than just trying to add quantity more than quality.
Don't disagree. There's lots in this report. As I said, we've only just had the chance to read the top level coverage of it. Worth digging into more and seeing what the future of media in Canada might look like and what the government actually takes out of this and acts on. But hey, they also call for universal broadband access, which would be good because everyone should be able to get on the internet.
Yeah, just challenging to do for the more rural and isolated parts of the country.
Just takes money. Lots and lots of it.
And that has been Politicos. Find links to everything we talked about at politicos.ca. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politicos. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Joshua Plotnikoff. Politicos is a production of Leg and Boot Media, and editing services are provided by Cortado Productions. Thanks for listening.